Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Buckle your seatbelts, folks. ISIS, the self-proclaimed Islamic State, ISIS wants you. Well, if you follow the dystopian apocalypse talk of the Book of Revelations in the Christian Bible, know something about the number 666 or the four horsemen, the rapture, the Antichrist, all of that, does that mean you would actually join up with some group to make it happen in your lifetime? There are Christian groups that profess such goals, but almost no one believes that the Pope is secretly rooting for them to succeed. Similarly, there are Jewish groups that believe a third temple of Solomon should be built in Jerusalem to bring on the Messiah. But no one seriously believes that most observant Jews or high-profile figures like Jerry Seinfeld or Jon Stewart or even most Israelis living in Tel Aviv are secretly rooting for that violent outcome. The Obama White House is trying to make this argument about Muslims and groups that call for caliphates in Syria like ISIS or call for attacks on U.S. shopping malls like al-Shabaab in Somalia did over the weekend. President Obama says this is not religious doctrine. It's desperation.
These terrorists are desperate for legitimacy. And all of us have a responsibility to refute the notion that groups like ISIL somehow represent Islam, because that is a falsehood that embraces the terrorist narrative.
Is this doctrine and preaching that's coming out of ISIS, or is it appropriation of a religion for a tactical purpose on the ground in Iraq and Syria? Graham Wood, author of What ISIS Really Wants in the March 2015 issue of The Atlantic, where he's also a contributing editor. Welcome, Graham.
Thank you.
Also with us is Haroon Mogal, a fellow at the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding. Previously, he was the fellow in Muslim Politics and Societies at the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. And Haroon recently wrote a rebuttal to Graham's piece for Salon. Graham, why don't you begin? Is this religion that's coming out of ISIS?
Well, ISIS is certainly using the trappings of religion, and it's using the same texts that that have existed in Islam for a long time. It's using them very selectively. It has interpretations and methods of interpretation that are extremely unpopular and shared by almost no Muslims other than ISIS. But certainly it's emerging from that tradition, and so I think it would be a mistake to call it totally not Islamic.
But if nobody buys it, what does it matter that it actually uses the words correctly?
It certainly is true that it doesn't represent Islam, but in the same way, the Branch Davidians and David Koresh, they don't represent Christianity. On the other hand, to say that the Branch Davidians are not a Christian sect, I think would be mistaken. And that's really what I was pushing up against, the idea that these people do not have any kind of rationality behind them, that they can't think. That I think, is a false view of our enemy. And we have to think of them instead as a deviant, kind of heretical Islamic sect, rather than just a bunch of nihilists, thrill-kill types.
Haroon, would you say there is an equivalence between Christian apocalyptic groups, Jewish apocalyptic groups, and Muslim apocalyptic groups? Or do Muslim apocalyptic groups have more of a connection with the religion in the way they're depicted in the media?
I think we're missing the most important part of the equation when it comes to ISIS, and that's the Iraq War. If any country had done to us what we did to Iraq, not since 2003, but since 1980 with the Iran-Iraq War, the Gulf War, the sanctions, invasion, civil war, sectarianism, you would produce apocalyptic groups. It's not surprising to me that a society that is so brutalized and devastated would produce brutes and barbarians. That said, of course, ISIS believes itself to be Islamic and attempts to find legitimacy within the Islamic tradition. But as Graham pointed out, no Muslim other than ISIS believes ISIS represents Islam. They're anathema, not only to Muslims but to Islamic scholarship.
Graham, do you believe that quietistic Muslims hope secretly for the success of ISIS, or are they just as outraged as everyone else?
As far as I can tell, quietistic Salafis are as foursquare against ISIS as you could possibly get, and on theological grounds, I should point out. As for the rest of Muslims and the vast majority of Muslims who have no interest in ISIS, I think it's almost as ridiculous to ask their opinion of ISIS as it would be to ask your neighborhood Baptist or Methodist about what they thought about the fundamentalist Church of Latter-day Saints or of the Branch Davidians. It's very far from their practice. That said, those churches certainly do share some holy texts, and they are in the holy tradition of Christianity.
Well, then I'm puzzled here. You, in your Atlantic piece, really make the case for treating ISIS seriously as a threat on some level. Yet you're also saying here that maybe the United States government should pay attention to ISIS about as much as the folks in Istanbul pay attention to the Branch Davidians.
You know, I think that we should take very, very careful note of what they think, of what ISIS thinks. And by doing that, we can understand exactly what their project is and exactly how they're appealing to the possibly radicalized people and populations outside of the Islamic State. Now, to acknowledge what they are, to acknowledge the traditions that they draw from, is not to legitimize their appropriation of those traditions. What it is understanding what our enemy is, describing it accurately so we can deal with it. If we went to war, for example, with Nazi Germany and we had no idea what Nazism consisted of, then I think we'd be in an analogous situation to the kinds of military confrontation that we've already chosen against ISIS, really without much knowledge of what they think in detail.
Haroon?
It's important that we take note of ISIS, but I think we're missing the point. And the point is, how have our policies contributed to this sort of movement and this sort of discourse? On the one hand, we're bombing ISIS. On the other hand, we're militarily protecting Saudi Arabia, whose brand of Islam directly leads into ISIS. Saudi Arabia has been a profoundly negative force within the Muslim world. Its brand of Islam is incredibly strident, intolerant, closed-minded, averse to other forms of the Islamic tradition, and emerged in opposition to the Islamic tradition collectively. So we're having this conversation rather self-righteously about how dangerous ISIS is, and as Bernard Haykel, you know, put it in his article rather inaccurately, that ISIS somehow is Islamic, which is an embarrassing conclusion for an academic to make. We're missing the point, and the point is, how do our own policies contribute to instability? And how do extremist groups take advantage of that instability?
But to use the Nazi example that Graham did a moment ago, do we wait for ISIS to invade Belgium before we do something about him?
No, not at all. I think the first thing we need to do when it comes to ISIS is consider how unpopular this movement is. Graham himself says it in his article. This is a movement that has absolutely no allies. Everywhere it goes, it creates opposition to itself. There is no movement in the world as unpopular as ISIS. It cannot survive. You can't build a state formed on this kind of rigidity and intolerance. So ISIS is waiting to fall. The only thing that will allow ISIS to succeed is if authoritarianism in the Middle East keeps throwing oxygen into a fire, so to speak, right? So what we need to do is really think about creating a coalition in the Middle East to contain ISIS. This is not Nazi Germany. This is not a group that has the second largest economy in the world as its primary resource or engine. It controls mostly desolate, uninhabited territory. It has no access to the sea. It has no alliances. It has no ability to produce technology. It's brutal. It's scary. It's dangerous. But let's not go so far as to pretend that this is Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union.
Graham?
We're very lucky that they're not either of those things. ISIS, as Haroon correctly points out, is a very small, poor movement with a base that can't possibly threaten the West in the way that it would like to, and that it says it will in its propaganda. That said, it is an expanding group. It has been arrested in the expansion on its own edges by Kurdish involvement, by the Iraqi Shia. But it's finding allegiance from places like Libya, places like the Caucasus, Afghanistan. And I think the methods of its expansion have to do very much with the way that it conceives itself and its ideology. So understanding exactly how a caliphate expands in their view of what a caliphate is, I think is a very good illustration of the importance of understanding their ideology.
But if I make an argument about a caliphate to someone sitting at a coffee place in Istanbul, they laugh at me. But if I make that argument about a caliphate would be a benefit for your life, if you're in Pakistan and drones are attacking you in your villages, you might actually buy that argument. So the U.S. complicity in making that argument credible is a reasonable one. Graham?
Yeah, that's a very important point in my article, which is that there's a narrative that ISIS has. It's all about burning the middle ground, so especially Muslims have to choose sides, and they have to choose sides between the Islamic State and being some kind of sellout to the West. And that's something that we need to avoid. We need to make sure that narrative is, first of all, not accurate, and second of all, is not popular among the possible recruits for ISIS. And that's why I think it's so dangerous for us to have any kind of very straightforward occupation or invasion of Islamic State territory. If we do that, we will certainly be buying into the line that that ISIS wants to promote to the rest of the world.
But the humanitarian impact of pulling out of the Syrian civil war and the region generally, Haroon, would be an absolute nightmare for millions of people.
Our intervention in the region has generally not gone well. Places where we've used military force generally have suffered. So logic dictates that we proceed very carefully and cautiously and with a degree of humility with respect to how much we can really accomplish. This is a problem the region has to figure out for itself. We can't simply swoop in, bomb people, and walk away and expect that the problem will simply go away. There are internal causes for ISIS as well. And there is a need for people in the region to figure out their own model of inclusive politics, and that's not happening. One of the reasons why it's so hard to find a clear position in the Muslim world on what to do about ISIS is that the people who are opposing ISIS are just as brutal, if not more so. They may not threaten the West, but with respect to Muslims, they've killed far more. So on the one hand, you have ISIS. On the other hand, you have the Assad administration and its Iranian backers who are engaged in ethnic cleansing against Sunni populations. So it's a case of a rock and a hard place. You're stuck between terrorism and authoritarianism. And in that environment, if there isn't an inclusive politics, it's going to be constant civil war. And the United States cannot force Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Syria, Iraq, so on and so forth, to build governments that include the diversity of their people. That's their challenge.
Some common ground here, Graham Wood?
Yes, certainly. I think that it's very important to understand that ISIS is a movement with its own self-destruction probably written within its constitution. You know, the ISIS does not have popularity outside of its territory. And very quickly, I think it will be, instead of an expanding caliphate of its propaganda, a pathetic and stagnating one. And that's really what we want. If we can dispel their narratives and show that they are not what they claim to be, then we're very much on the right page. And understanding that's going to be, of course, complicated, and it will require us to understand how Bashar al-Assad's government is related to all this. But certainly understanding the self-conception of ISIS is going to be part of it, too.
Our mission, finding common ground between Graham Wood, author of What ISIS Really Wants in the March 2015 issue of The Atlantic, and Haroon Mogul, a fellow at the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding, who wrote a rebuttal of that piece for Salon. Haroon and Graham, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking about net neutrality. The FCC is voting this week. What does it mean to have reliable, affordable internet in this country?
Hi, my name is Stephanie. I'm calling from North Fort Worth. And today my internet service is, well, it's taking me hours to watch one movie because it keeps dropping. At this rate, I will have wasted the cost thanks to Charter's unreliable and inconsistent service.
When and how your internet service might improve, the net neutrality discussion on The Takeaway all week long, 877-8-MY-TAKE, to tell your story.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. The new comedy directed by John Madden, starring Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nye, Dev Patel, and Richard Gere, in theaters everywhere March 6th.
The Federal Communications Commission will vote this Thursday on a set of rules to govern net neutrality. Activists, lobbyists, and average internet users are eagerly awaiting what is arguably the most important FCC vote in recent history. But what is net neutrality without reliable and affordable access to the World Wide Web? It's a question we're asking all week long on The Takeaway, and we'll check in over the next few days with people living in internet utopias and some internet dead zones as well. But let's set the stage this week by talking to the man who came up with the term net neutrality. Of course, he's a law professor, Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia University.
At its most original form, net neutrality was a principle of how the companies carrying information should act. So it's, you know, like an ethical rule, like don't lie, don't degrade. What we've seen now is a legal enforcement by the government of the net neutrality principle. So if that makes sense, the ethic of net neutrality is don't discriminate, don't mess with stuff on the internet. And the law of net neutrality enforces that ethic.
Do you suspect that the FCC will attempt to enforce a principle, or will in the end deliver some sort of compromise, which is actually not net neutrality?
Oh, I think right now they're doing a pretty good job. And I think they will, frankly, come up with a rule that I will consider ensuring net neutrality. So, you know, they've changed their tune over the year and have gone basically full bore for the net neutrality approach. So I think they're not going to compromise, actually.
If we look around the world, who has the best internet service and why? Is it because of a great monopoly, a provider in their community? Is it because of a progressive government insistence on some level of service? What gives people the best service in your experience in looking around the world?
Yeah, I think the model is widely considered to be Korea, although a couple of other countries like the Netherlands are close behind. And I think it just is the product of government infrastructure spending. Some governments think of the internet as part of public infrastructure like the highways or bridges, and governments outside the United States spend a lot of money on public infrastructure. We spend some, but other countries spend more, and those countries tend to have the fastest internet service. What we do have that other countries don't have so much is we have a cable industry that wired most homes in the 1970s and 80s with pretty good wires, those coax cables. That has given the United States actually an advantage. The problem in the United States is not so much our infrastructure as much as the insistence on wringing every single last cent of profit out of those pipes. You know, when you say, well, why don't they offer much more bandwidth? The companies are saying, well, how are we going to make money out of that, as opposed to why would that be good for the country? You know, it's as if we had private companies building the highways and they were like, well, these traffic jams, they're not really hurting our business model. You see what I'm saying? I mean, the problem and the reason for net neutrality sometimes is that the infrastructure owners, this is definitely getting wonky, can sometimes profit from congestion. Ah. And so, you know, that's the key. And so one of the rules of net neutrality is we don't want to make congestion an attractive business model. We want to try and encourage you to try and make the biggest, fattest pipes, the most bandwidth available. And that's by outlawing certain business models and allowing others.
And that's what you think the FCC is going to do. By the way, I think that the congestion is not wonky. I think people very much understand what that's all about.
I mean, without net neutrality, the cable and phone companies, they're like, there's the internet. It's really slow. Hey, let's say Netflix. Hey, Blogger, do you want to get through that congestion? Here's a fast line, you know, and we're going to sell it to you. It's a little bit the way, you know, boarding an airplane has become terrible, in part so that the airplane could sell you an upgrade to get past the big crowd getting on the airplane. You know, that's a little bit what could happen on the internet. And net neutrality is like, listen, you can't start selling these slow lanes and fast lanes and trying to mess with everything and make money off congestion.
What do you think is the importance of this moment?
I think it's historically extremely important. It marks a return to an idea that maybe the private sector doesn't do everything we want always in infrastructure, that we have public values at stake here. And an open and free internet is a big part of that. And I guess in the 90s and early 2000s, the idea was, well, we can always trust the cable industry to do the best for the public. I just don't think people buy that anymore. You know, they look at their unregulated cable prices and they seem out of control. They don't really trust private business. So I think it's a big moment.
Is it possible for the government? The government doesn't necessarily have a great track record in setting conditions and establishing law in the technology realm that's changing so rapidly. I'm wondering if they can guarantee something that's going to still be relevant in 10 or 20 years, or do they have to take the approach, whatever the best solution is at any given moment, that's what you have to offer to consumers. Anything short of that is going to be obsolete.
I think government does a terrible job when it sort of tries to imagine the future. I think government does a better job when it says, thou shall not. And in net neutrality, there's a bunch of rules, thou shall not block, thou shall not discriminate. And so I think there's a better chance that those principles, which are a little more universal, will succeed than the sort of typical government, all right, here's our vision of the future of television, and this is why we want to make it so. So I'm maybe I'm biased, but I hope by going to ancient, almost medieval principles in net neutrality, which are basically the same principles that govern things like canals and it's actually not that different than what regulates taxis, in the sense that when you get in a taxi, the taxi has to take you where you want to go. And that's basically all that net neutrality says as well. So I have some confidence.
Tim Wu is professor of law at Columbia and the man credited with coining the term net neutrality. And because he's a complete wonk on this stuff, I decided to get his review of the best city outside of Korea and Scandinavia for internet service.
Well, Kansas City would probably be the best right
really?
Now.
Really?
Google has wired Kansas City. And as a consequence, the cable companies and phone companies have felt they'd have to offer better service. So, you know, they're racing to the top in Kansas City, not just in barbecue, but also in bandwidth.
Tomorrow we speak with the mayor of Kansas City, Missouri, about how other cities can follow their lead and close the digital divide. So how would you rate the internet service where you live? From Seattle, Washington, I'm fine in West Seattle, but my mother-in-law has dial-up in New Plymouth, Idaho, so we can't send her videos of our son. Oh, that's too bad. Tulsa, Oklahoma, I just moved into a home out in the country. The only internet I have is when I put my cell phone in the windows and get enough service to get online.
This is Erica from Parkland, Florida. Our internet is typically fast. It was slow yesterday, so my husband checked and we had 28 devices connected to our internet. We're just a family of four. That's crazy. We're constantly connected, and we always want more speed.
Internet as a public utility. What do you think? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. If your internet is fast enough, you can vote in our poll online at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com. Brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
The scientific consensus on climate change and its human causes has been unassailable in the scientific community. In politics, though, it's something else. And among the voices declaring that the variations we have seen in climate that may explain the last two decades of warming trends could come from the solar variations is Willie Soon at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Such ideas are popular with politicians who don't buy climate change. But the question facing Mr. Soon right now is whether his science was bought by folks with an interest in disputing the scientific consensus. Documents released to Greenpeace via a 2013 Freedom of Information Act request shows that Dr. Soon received over $1.2 million in funding since 2001 from oil and gas companies, lobbies, and conservative foundations. Naomi Oreskes is a professor of history and science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. Professor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So receiving the money is one thing, not disclosing it is something else. Can you describe these two offenses in terms of how it causes us to look at his scientific results?
Sure. Lots of researchers receive money from various diverse sources, including private sector sources. So I don't think that anyone here is claiming that the fact of getting money from a private source is necessarily a problem. The question is the potential for conflict of interest. And because we know, common sense tells us, research tells us, that when people get funding from sources who have very specific interests in mind, as we know the fossil fuel industry does, that can potentially have a distorting and corrupting influence on the science. And because we know that potentially exists, we have rules for disclosure. That is to say, if a person takes money from the fossil fuel industry or the chemical industry or the pesticide industry or a left-wing organization as well, the rules of academic integrity say you have to disclose that because your readers have the right to know who's funding the research in case, not necessarily, but in case there is a conflict that could distort the scientific results, because then we can judge the results knowing that there is that potential for conflict and compromise.
Dr. Soon is on the record being not terribly discriminating, it would seem, with the funding sources. He doesn't mention disclosure here, but listen.
And I've been receiving money from whoever that wants to give me money. I write my scientific proposal. I have received money from ExxonMobil, but ExxonMobil no longer give me any money for a long time. American Petroleum Institute. Anything you wish for from Southern Company, from all these companies. I write proposal. I let them judge whether they will fund me or not.
It sounds like he's conflating the agreement to fund his proposal with the idea that he would be accepted in a scientific journal. They're very different evaluations there.
Absolutely. And scientific journals rely on the honesty and integrity of researchers when they send things out for peer review. So when I receive an article to be peer reviewed, I'm assuming that that author has disclosed any potential conflict of interest so that if anything, the paper might be affected by that, I can make that judgment. But what we know Dr. Soon did was to fail to disclose his sources in the papers he submitted to journals so that the reviewers were not aware of the fact that he had, in fact, received over $1 million from fossil fuel companies.
And the Smithsonian says it's greatly concerned about these allegations. It is taking immediate action to address the issue. And the acting secretary has asked the Smithsonian Inspector General to review the matter. Does this disqualify all of Soon's results?
Well, I think that's a matter of judgment. My own view is that any paper that he submitted without disclosing potential conflicts of interest should be retracted by the journals that publish them, because he's violated the most basic fundamental principles of academic integrity that we all depend upon to know that the research is, in fact, independent and objective.
Where do you stand on solar variation being an explanation for climate change?
Yeah, right. That's about hard to take seriously. All we can say is, of course, there's solar variation. We all know that. No one denies it. But the scientific evidence is overwhelming that solar variation does not explain the observed increase in warming. And it's not just the last two decades, as you mentioned in the introduction. It's actually the last half a century.
Naomi Oreskes is professor of history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
For parents looking at schools for their college-bound kids, this is not something that comes up typically on the campus tour.
It was at night. We were dancing. I was out with some friends. People were drinking, but nobody was ridiculously drunk, and I got pulled outside and banged my head against a wall and was raped.
He just started kind of like pulling me towards the bathroom. He grabbed my head by the side of my ear and slammed it against the bathroom tile. And it didn't stop.
Two victims from the University of North Carolina. They could be from any school around the country, though, sharing their stories of being victims of sexual assault in the new documentary, The Hunting Ground, which looks at what it means that 25% of students can expect to become assault victims during their time on campuses. The Hunting Game explores just how hard it is to prosecute these cases and how schools, in many cases, actively discourage enforcement of existing laws. The film is written and directed by Kirby Dick and produced by Amy Ziering, the Oscar-nominated team that investigated sexual assault in the military for the movie The Invisible War.
I mean, we had just finished our film Invisible War on the military, and we had obviously anticipated that that institution would be a little less forthcoming than you would expect. And we thought that schools, contrarily, would be more transparent. But we found just the opposite, right, Kirby?
Yeah. You know, you think of a university as a free speech zone, really. I mean, that's what I think about it when I think about it. But when it came to this, very many people in the administration and the faculty knew this was a problem, and very few people were, most people, nearly all people were afraid to speak out about it.
Who did speak, and what did students say to you?
We spoke with well over 100 survivors and interviewed,
close to 60 on camera.
Yes.
Over and over again, the stories were uncannily echoed one another. They were, you know, an assault that happened. And then the student sort of naively would assume that the institution would sort of be eager to help them, support them, et cetera. And ironically, the student time and time again would find just the opposite was true.
They kept asking me, like, what were you wearing? Like, what were you drinking? Like, how much did you have to drink? Did you pregame?
He kind of just lectured us about how we shouldn't go out in short skirts and we shouldn't drink because, I mean, that's our fault.
Did you say no? How many times did you say no? How did you say it? Okay, what were you wearing?
There was no response. There was no response for 7 months.
I thought that if I told them, like, they would take action. But the only action they took was against me.
She said, I should just drop out until everything blows over, out of school.
I went back into her office and I asked her what happened, and she looked me right in the eye and told me that she forgot.
The school's response always seemed like they were more concerned about him and his needs.
She said, you don't know what he's going through right now, neither do I. He could be really having a hard time.
And we found this across all schools. I mean, whether it was, Ivy League schools, big football schools, small liberal arts schools, state schools. I mean, it was a problem at every school. This is across higher education.
And if you look at the circumstances of higher education, you've got young people in a high-stress environment with suddenly the rules have been taken off once they turn 18. Does that contribute to this, or is there something else going on that enables this sort of thing to happen?
Well, I mean, you have people coming from high school going into college thinking it's a safe environment, and in most situations it is. But there are some environments that aren't safe. I mean, there are situations where people go to parties, they think it's especially safe, and what you have there is, at those parties, and we found this out, is you have serial predators who've assaulted before looking to find someone to assault them. Now, most men in colleges and are not, you know, would never assault a woman or a man, but there are a small minority of men who do it again and again, and this is the same thing we found in the military.
How does this ruin college for the people that you talk to?
Oh, my God. Wow.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah. It completely really decimates their experience.
I mean, it really affects their academic performance. I mean, whether they come forward or not, in many, many cases, unfortunately, in most cases, in fact, well over 80%, women and men who are assaulted don't even report it to any kind of authority. But for all of them, I mean, it really affects their academic performance. They oftentimes people drop out of school. They have to take a semester off. Sometimes they never go back to school. We know of a number of students like that. I mean, it's profoundly impacting.
And the reason that is unlike in civilian life or in the public, you are trapped on this campus with your perpetrator. And if there's nothing going on and there's no investigations or any processes going forward, then you end up, you know, running into him, and no place seems safe, and that's terrifying.
Yeah, no, I mean, we heard that over and over from the survivors we spoke with.
And are men targets?
Yes, mostly by men, but in some cases by women as well. And it's even harder for them to report.
You know, parent beware. I happen to be a parent with two high school juniors who are looking at colleges right now. Is there any way for me to know how to distinguish one institution from the other based on your research?
Well, transparency. That's the first thing I'd look for. I mean, I think very few schools are doing this right. I mean, just kind of say Yale is doing something right on this. I mean, they have their issues, but they're doing something right. They have a survey that's done, I think, twice a year that not only do they list the number of reports, but they list how those processes were adjudicated and what the consequences were if people were found responsible. That's a good sign. Schools have to be willing to put a lot of money into the investigation and adjudication systems so that when somebody does report, they will be able to find out, A, if this is an accurate report, but B, be able to go through the process and then find this person responsible and, in most cases, hopefully, remove them from the campus.
When a prosecution doesn't take place, does that continue a trauma in the interviews that you did?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Time and again, what I heard from survivors was not only was the assault, itself horrific, but everything that happened in the aftermath really compounded the trauma exponentially, which was interesting and strange. So it wasn't even, they said they might have been able to get past that, but it was really sort of the constant failure of anyone to believe them, support them, and then for them to have any access to any kind of fair adjudication system. And what we found in situations where that did happen, the person healed and could pass through the incident a lot more quickly, even if the prosecution wasn't successful.
These students, just like in the military, these students expect their school to do the right thing. Anybody coming forward does it because they have faith and trust that their school will be the right thing. And so when it doesn't, it's a double betrayal.
Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Writer and director Kirby Dick and producer Amy Ziering are the team behind The Hunting Ground, a new documentary about sexual assault on college campuses.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
We're discussing internet envy around the world.
Hi, my name is Dave in Ohio. In Romania, we had faster internet speed than what I currently have in Ohio. Two things in Romania that work better than in the States: riot police and internet.
Love that. We're talking about net neutrality all this week, and you can join me and Marvin Amori, a net neutrality advocate, for a Twitter chat later this week. Visit thetakeaway.org for more information or to listen back to anything you heard on this program. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.